Hey, everybody, Scott here. Welcome to episode 204 of Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. We got a really fun one for you today, so let's get right to it. Let's talk about some of the sponsors real quick before we begin. One of them happens to be Wolf Nation Apparel, W-U-L-F Nation. That is Wake Up, Live Free. Wolf Nation is an up-and-coming clothing brand. They are putting out all sorts of different things, gauging interest in what people like and what what they're going to go ahead with. Wake Up, Live Free means, it's only a dream unless you're pursuing it. Apparel for men, women, children, dogs, just an up-and-coming brand that we love to work with. They happen to just put out leggings for females. They just released varsity leggings, sports tank top for ladies. They add camouflage hats, shirts, Rolls Royce designs, Coca-Cola designs. And best of all, tomorrow they're throwing up their website as wolfnation.rocks. www.wolfnation.rocks. And again, that is Wake Up, Live Free. Now, another longtime sponsor of the podcast has been Manskirt Brewing. Manskirt Brewing is located in Hackettstown, New Jersey, in the old bank building. And they are just an awesome brewery to go get grab a beer, play a game, sit and hang out, try their 8 different rotating taps. Just really good stuff from Manskirt, always delivering good product, seasonally inspired ales. Go check out Joe in his Manskirt. They just changed their hours. They're going to be open until 10 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays and 6 p.m. on Sundays. They also just put out Penny Top Amber and Gold Bar Blonde. They made their triumphant return. So make sure you go grab a craft beer at Manskirt Brewing. Finally, Trivia Revolution. Trivia Revolution is a trivia company located all over the state of New Jersey in beer bars and breweries. Come out, win some prizes to those places or craft breweries throughout New Jersey. You can be in last place and still win. So you don't have to be smart, meaning most of my friends would have a chance. So again, that is Trivia Revolution fueled by craft beer. All right, we got two awesome guests on the podcast today. One of them happens to be the owner and co-creator of Hunt a Killer, which is a game that you play with people, figure out who did it. You get a monthly package. This is a really cool concept, and it's exploding everywhere. So hear all about that with Ryan Hogan, okay? And then Bob Rush. Bob Rush is an actor. You may know him as Skeeter from Sons of Anarchy, or you might know him as Doyle McPoyle from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. So again, that is Bob Rush. So guys, we got a really fun one today. So with that, enjoy the podcast.
Hey, this is Ryan Hogan, co-founder and CEO of Hunt a Killer, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
Hi, this is Bob Rush, a.k.a. Doyle McPoyle from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. You're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheap and fun. Shenanigans are cool and tragic. Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
All right. Hello. 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 You've joined me for my favorite part of the podcast, which is the intro.
The intro.
The intro is always like this. It always feels very contrived and kind of weird and kind of like I'm like trying to get new listeners, which I am. Welcome everybody to Verbal Shenanigans. That's the name of this show. That's the that's what you've tuned into. That's what you're.
The tagline?
Your iPhone or whatever you're listening on, iTunes or Stitcher or whatever the hell your favorite podcast listening app is. Welcome to Verbal Shenanigans, a show where we generally try to just find passionate people and interview them or unique people or whatnot. But I'm Scott Brennan, and over there in sweet Georgia is Mike Berlew.
Here I am, Scotty, here for another week of excitement and adventure.
You sound like someone on like a kid's show that just like got signed on for like 10 seasons and really can't breach their contract.
Yeah, the kid started when he was like 9 years old, and now he's in college. He's like, God
damn it, am I still doing this? And talking to that mountain thing from Legends of the Hidden Temple again? God,
what do you want, Olmec? What do you want?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not your friend. I want nothing to do with you, Olmec. No, you can't borrow my car.
I heard they made a movie about that. I never saw it. I'm not sure if it went right to Nickelodeon, but I heard they made a movie about Legends of the Hidden Temple.
They made an Olmec movie?
At least of the game. I would assume he is in the movie. I mean, that'd be pretty cheap if they didn't, but I heard that. I would have to look it up, but I heard they made a movie around Legends of the Hidden Temple.
The whole plot was like them trying to put together that three-piece monkey statue that everyone seemed to fail on, even though it was butt, midsection, and head.
Yeah, I read one of those slideshows about the show where they literally said it was one of the most impossible things to get done because you didn't know what was up or down for that thing, but
Who knows? I just think it was a lot of dumb kids.
Mm-hmm. And apparently a lot of kids almost crapped their pants when those guards came out and grabbed them during the show.
Good. Training them for real life training. But but now I know who we want on our next show. The voice of Olmec. So let's mark that down.
I'll get on it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm writing as we speak Olmec's voice.
Can you do the entire interview like you're a piece of rock that can talk? Would that be cool?
Yes, guys. I'm from Purple Dragons. You do not make it. Or Purple Parrots.
Yeah, the Purple Parrots, Silver Snakes, orange Iguanas.
Too.
Let's see. What was the red team? Blue Iguanas.
Red Babblers.
I remember that.
Red, I don't know. But anyway, let's not waste our time with
the Red Monkey. Oh, I think it was a red monkey.
Great. I'm so happy. I always wanted a piece of the... I always wanted to go on Guts. That's what I always wanted to go on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a very underrated show from Nickelodeon. You know? That was pretty good. Guts Michael Malley.
The Aggro Crag.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Mo. You'll be shocked. I have tried to reach out to Mo before and Mike O'Malley, and both have not gotten back to me. So I guess they've gone on to bigger and better things, and they don't want to be on the promotion.
Yeah, I used to like a show called Finders Keepers. Nobody remembers that one. It's where it's basically you solved a puzzle, and then you went into a house, and then you had to rip it apart to try to find a... something from a clue. And I always liked it a lot, but remembers it.
That's kind of cool. Guts was my show back in the day. I really thought I would do really good on Guts, and I still would like to do like adult Guts if they're listening. I want a piece of that aggro crag.
How about Adult Wild and Crazy Kids? No, probably not.
That was a good show, too.
That really did not sound right, no. That sounds like the wrong kind of movie that gets you in jail with Jared from Subway.
speaking of just like episodes and guests real quick, if you listen to last week's episode, we interviewed Kirby Chambliss, who is arguably one of my favorite guests. He's just a genuine dude, but he is an air race pilot for Red Bull, and he was promoting a video on there that came out. Mike, I don't know if you got a chance to see it. But it's ridiculous. it's like crazy. It's hot air balloons going up in the air, and he's got these LED lights on the plane, and he's weaving in and out of hot air balloons. You guys need to go check this out. One title is When Hot Air Balloons Met the Cool Kirby Chambliss. Just Google Kirby Chambliss hot air balloons. It's ridiculous.
I mean, it's all cool for him. I wonder how the people in the hot air balloon were feeling and all that. I mean, that's got to be shaking the basket a little bit.
Yeah. like I said, I was not happy when I went up in a hot air balloon. Never mind a plane coming right at me.
You're just flying out of the basket and all Red Bull, gets.
Frightening.
How so?
Well, first... the noise was horrific. It was like, hi, 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 scan. And then your face was also frozen on my screen, like in a very like wide eye, staring like right through me, like the Mona Lisa, like where the eyes are following you kind of picture.
Yeah,
but it was great. But hopefully your new house has rock solid Wi-Fi.
Yeah, it might be delayed. I may not be getting into it to the end of the month.
Oh, well, that's only like 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's not disastrous. It was going to be this Friday, and then as we were like finishing up with the lawyers, they were saying, okay, what time on the 15th? And I replied to the email, and they're like, oh, yeah, didn't you hear from the owner's names and all? They may need to the 28th or something like that. So basically their house fell through, so they're just trying to get a rental and get out of there. So we'll see. It'll either be next week or 2 weeks from now, but I'll get in there eventually.
Yeah, that's not a lot of time. All right, Mike. I got poison ivy so bad right now on my ankles. I'm ready to go with what was that? Was that Oscar Pistorius, the guy with the Blade Runner feet? Was that his name?
Yeah. It's something like that. Yeah, the one. Did he end up in jail? I forget.
I don't know. He shot his girlfriend or fiance or something through the bathroom door. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see. Oscar Pistorius. Yeah. He was the guy with the fake feet. But I'm ready to lop my ankle off because it's so itchy and I just scratch it so horrifically bad. Do you get poison ivy bad?
Knock on wood, I can't remember the last time I've had poison ivy. I go out, I once in a while walk the dog through the woods and all. I don't keep track of like the kind of bushes I go through or anything like that, but I don't generally come home with anything worth noting of concern with them.
Oh, I remember poison ivy. One time I got it so bad it was like spreading to my groin, and like I'm not even being gross, or not my dong, but like my groin, like even the groin's kind of like a sweatier area where like fabric sits on top of too, like it's not, you know, it's an area where there's a lot of contact.
It gets irritated very easily.
Yes, and it was horrific. I remember it spreading all up like my chest, and I remember I had to go on like they put me on like a local steroid or something like that to get rid of it. It was horrific, but now I just got it on my ankles. It's pretty bad, but anyway.
Going through anywhere of notes?
I think it was last weekend when I was up in the Adirondacks and took the dog in the woods. I mean, not the dog. Actually, we didn't bring the dog, so that would be hard. I do take the dog in the woods a lot, but we went for a hike in the woods. By dog, I am not talking about my fiance either. That's pretty terrible.
I eat your ass. Don't get mad at us, okay? You didn't mean that. You didn't mean that in the way you think.
Oh, my God. They're horrible.
Every time I pick a random episode, they're doing this.
they're woman bashers. I hate them. But anyway, I know you. What do you got today?
Well, Scott, when weird stories come from somewhere, where do they usually come from?
Florida.
That's correct, Scott. So I have five animal stories here.
Yes.
You have to tell me which one of these five is not from Florida.
Oh, good. My favorite place, Florida.
Mm-hmm. King of the what the hell happened again? Mm-hmm. All right. Story number one. A diaper-wearing pet monkey attacked a Home Depot employee who was trying to find the monkey's owner. This incident happened on Monday. The monkey's owner, Tina Ballard, told deputies she left her pet monkey in her truck on a leash. However, the monkey escaped from the vehicle and wandered the parking lot. Marilyn Howard, the worker who was attacked, told deputies that she was taking a break outside the store when she heard coworkers yelling about a monkey.
Very believable. Howard, very believable.
Yeah, very much so. Howard said that she then spotted the monkey walking towards her. She grabbed the monkey's leash when it climbed on her and bit her twice on the back. According to the like deputies.
Anyone who has a monkey deserves to be bit in the back twice.
Well, keep in mind, this was the Good Samaritan who was trying to find the monkey's owner.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So the story is the monkey's owner left her pet monkey in her truck in the heat of Florida, but somehow the monkey got loose, and as the Home Depot worker tried to find the owner, the monkey went, lack of a better term, apeshit on her.
I see what you did there. I see what you did. Mm-hmm. Now, my question is, now that you have moved very close to Florida, do you expect more of these type of things to happen?
I don't think so. I think I'm outside the, you know, those trucks.
No one ever thinks so until it happens to them.
Well, you know those like charts they make where, like, if an atomic bomb hits, this is the worst zones. These are the semi-bad zones. These are the all right zones, and these are the good zones. I'm still in the good zone right now. I haven't gone to the heart of the matter, so I'm still kind of safe right now.
Okay, so we. Go ahead.
So we got the monkey that bit the Home Depot person trying to find the owner. As a side note, the Animal Control Wildlife Commission was notified about the incident. They had to, I believe they had to take the monkey away from the owner because they didn't have a proper permit to have a monkey.
Now, my question is, when something like that happens, where does the monkey go?
Like, I don't know. Can they just take it to the dog pound?
Is it sitting in a cell? Because I don't trust a monkey anywhere near a dog. They're way smarter and weirder. I may have stated before, I don't really like monkeys that much. Not that big of a fan.
Then you're not going to like story number two, Scott.
Too smart, too similar to humans. I don't like that weird smile they do. I don't like that they're way stronger than us, like way, way stronger than us. That, like, you should never have a monkey as a pet. Like, an orangutan will rip your arms off and, like take your jaw off and throw it around and eat your face. But yet people still think it's cute to have a monkey that can speak languages. Like, listen, I make enough weird voices. You make enough weird voices for my dog. I don't need him to be able to outthink me. And the older
you
I'm...
You need an advantage over the animal.
Yes,
what you're trying to
say. I need to have an intellectual advantage over my pet because, listen, as the years are going by, like, I was probably way smarter from episode one than I am now, 200 and something episodes later. Like, I don't trust my brain anymore. It's mush at this point. I don't want a pet that is easily smarter than me.
Yeah. I mean, if they put it in a cage, I mean, if figured out a way to get out of a truck, who knows if it can't figure out for a cage.
First off, I've watched these videos on, like, octopus and stuff like that and how they are able to get out of cages, like in aquariums. They try to keep them and they figure ways out of the aquarium. I've seen them where they put them in jars and they're able to open the jar and figure out how to twist it off. Like, I am not that smart. If I was put into a giant man-sized jar, I would just give up.
I guess I'm gone. Hopefully they'll put some holes on the top, but pretty much I'm ready to meet my maker.
Yeah, I'm just like, I just give up. I just give up. I'm Bourdaining myself.
All right, you ready for story number two, Scott?
Yeah, sorry I went off on a little monkey prejudice rant.
That's what we're here for, Scotty. A man is facing charges after deputies say he shot a dog for pooping in the house. The sheriff's office was called to a home just before 7 p.m. Sunday for an animal complaint. Right. Responding deputies say 80-year-old David Zayas shot a 13-year-old chocolate lab mix that was standing in front of him. Deputies say Zayas told them he did it because he had pooped on the floor inside the house. Now, the kicker of this is when the deputies told Zayas it was wrong for him to shoot the dog, they said he responded and told them, quote unquote, "Not where I'm from, it's totally legal in Connecticut."
All right.
All right. I know you hate monkeys, but we're going back to monkeys.
I don't like monkeys.
I'm sorry. A man had to be separated from his Capuchin monkey after he was arrested for reportedly driving a stolen vehicle into a ditch. The monkey named Monk was clinging to the shirt of Cody Blake Henson, who was arrested for auto theft.
You know why this is believable? Because
why?
A person from Florida would name their monkey Monk.
It was a very popular TV show for a while on the USA Network.
Zero creativity, dumb. Someone who would own a monkey, someone would who would actively buy an animal that would outsmart them, would name their monkey Monk.
Henson did not have a permit for the animal and could face additional charges. Wildlife officials took possession of the monkey and took it to the primate sanctuary for evaluation. So apparently there are primate sanctuaries in this world.
A.K.A. prison cell 412 with the child molesters.
Yeah, monkey Oz.
there were monkeys in Oz. Remember them? The flying monkeys?
Oh, I was talking about the jail TV show.
I know.
Oh, gotcha.
It was a bad joke. Let's go with it. Go.
All right. Pastor killed by crocodile while performing baptism in lake. On a Sunday, a pastor was killed by a crocodile while performing a baptism in a lake. The pastor was conducting ceremony for about 80 people at the lake when the reptile leaped from the water and attacked him.
Yes.
One witness said the pastor had just baptized the first person and was about to baptize another when the crocodile jumped out. They repeated that line for some reason. Anyway, the pastor died from crocodile bites to his leg, back, and hands. Fishermen and other locals using fishing nets to prevent the crocodile from taking his body into the water.
Yes. I love this.
Mm. And finally, Panther
Are Bowling. All these are all true stories.
These are all true stories. Okay. Only one of them did not happen in Florida.
Okay, got it.
And finally, panther mauling family's cat caught on video. Madeline Lopez was at work Sunday morning when she received an alert on her phone from her motion-activated home security system. A live stream from a camera monitoring her estate driveway began to play. Her gaze fixed to her phone screen, Lopez watched helplessly as a panther chased down her beloved cat, River, pinned her to the concrete, dug its teeth into its neck, and hauled squealing feline away. I went into panic mode. I started crying, Lopez said. I couldn't believe what I was watching. After their 5-month-old American bully, King, had started barking, waking up her husband, Lopez said he had no idea what had happened until she sent him the video of the attack. Their two girls, aged 10, 9, and 5-year-old boy, were fast asleep. No one else was hurt, but the family's pain over the loss of their pet is still fresh.
All right. So now I got to pick the one that is not from Florida. Now I have an idea of what I think it might be.
Okay.
There's a lot of Florida-type animals in the story, like a panther, which I hear is a big problem, like wild cats and like coyotes eating people's dogs, mountain lions especially. Now, the monkey one, I think, is true because it sounds almost too Floridian. It sounds just like it should be. So the story I'm leaning towards is the alligator one, where the now you would say that the gators, that must be Florida, but I mean, I know there's gators in other places like Louisiana and Alabama and stuff like that. And I feel like you may have put a gator story in there to try to throw me off. Like, yo, that's definitely Florida. So my final answer is the gator story.
Okay, let's go through the list. The pet monkey that attacked a Home Depot employee happened in Okeechobee, Florida.
Yes.
That's where my parents have a summer home.
Oh, good. I'm good. Maybe they should get a monkey, too.
Yeah. The man who shot a dog for pooping in the house happened in Zephyr Hills, Florida.
Yes. It'd be great if, like, you had to podcast from somewhere with a monkey, like where my dog is barking in the background, like, hold on, the monkey cracked the Wi-Fi again. I can't figure this out.
Who was driving away in a stolen vehicle with the monkey, Cody Blake Hessen, that occurred in Holiday, Florida.
Yes. That was the one that was, I thought maybe like you were putting two monkey stories in there. Like one monkey would be Florida, one would be elsewhere. But I think it's Florida. So here we go. I'm down to two.
Down to two. Okay. The panther mauling the family's cat was in Naples, Florida.
Yes!
The pastor who got killed by a crocodile was in Ethiopia.
Yes! Yes! For
yeah,
once...
Brendan, you know you're Floridian.
For once, I am victorious in one of these games. Yes!
It's been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, I haven't won in a long time. Like, even like the silly ones with quotes. Remember when I was trying to... What, it was Martin Luther King and Trump? I couldn't even get that right.
Yeah.
Yes! Yes! Yes. Well, I am a champion. What it comes down to, you're welcome. You're welcome. All right. It's guess time.
Guess.
Oh, no, keep going.
That's all I got. No. Well, that was a whole song. It took me 3 hours to come up with.
That's what you got? You used to have way more obnoxious songs.
No. I said keep it simple, you know. It's like the remix. I mean, eventually I'll get, like, Diddy or somebody to put some beats behind it, but and just repeat it about 25 times in the club, but that's what it is.
So you would go out and get Diddy to do that, but not do an interview on the show. Thanks, pal.
No. The important thing is my song is out there for the world.
Yes. But anyway.
So you call it like the V shizzle.
So I think it's guest time. You know, we're done talking about us and our lives. So who we got?
We have Ryan Hogan. He is the co-founder.
Hulk Hogan's son. Yes. Hulk Hogan's son coming on the show.
We don't want.
Without further ado, the Hulkster's son, Ryan Hogan, everybody.
No, that's not it. Plus, Hogan's son did some car stuff that we probably don't want to promote.
Oh.
He got in an accident. Some people are not on this earth anymore because of that guy.
Is he dead?
No, he's alive, but he basically drove a car 100-some miles an hour. I think he was drunk, and one of his friends got killed in the accident. So,
gotcha. Okay, well, he's going to be a hard interview. So without further ado,
yeah.
Hulk Hogan's son, Ryan Hogan, everybody.
No, Scott, he has no relation to the Hulkster whatsoever.
Oh.
He is not Terry Bollea's real son.
Oh. All right, well, then this
is Ryan... All right, this is Ryan Hogan. He's the co-founder and CEO of Hunt a Killer.
The
monthly mystery box game that creates a community of hunters from across the world trying to solve a mystery.
Yes. I have heard this advertised a lot lately. It seems to be a game that a lot of people are subscribing to. We got our little kits. I didn't really try anything too much yet. I opened it up, looked at it a little bit. It looks very interesting, and it looks like something I might even try the first case and see how much I like it. Maybe we can communicate and be like killer finders together.
Yeah, exactly. That'll be our next podcast, Killer Finders.
Yeah.
With Scott and Mike.
Yeah.
Scott, stop pointing.
Found him. But anyway, from Hunt the Killer, here is Ryan Hogan.
All right, we are joined. We are joined by a co-founder and CEO of something called Hunt a Killer. Ryan Hogan, welcome. Welcome to Verbal Shenanigans. This is Scott and Mike. Thanks for giving us a few minutes here.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me.
First off, you say Hunt a Killer right away, and people go, what? Or like, huh? So
you didn't give any thought to like Candyland or something like that when you started getting into gaming?
Yeah, I think that was already taken, but yeah.
Chutes and Ladders 2. So, all right, I guess we got to start at the beginning. Where did you come up with this? First off, I guess before even that, what is Hunt the Killer? I've heard them on you guys advertised on a couple podcasts I listen to, and seen your stuff pop up here and there on the internet. But people who have never heard of this, what exactly is Hunt the Killer?
Sure. So Hunt the Killer at its core is immersive storytelling, right? And so immersive storytelling for Hunt the Killer, the delivery of physical items, so clues and correspondence, that are delivered each month episodically to your doorstep. And so it's kind of like we've built this universe, and instead of going out and going to the movie theater or watching a television series, you actually become a part of the story through this kind of immersive layer that's delivered to your doorstep.
Now, when you came up with this, were you a gaming guy, or were you more into like true crime, or what actually gave you the idea to do this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I think my partner and I we've been in the experiential business for quite some time, but we've been more into live events. And so Hunt a Killer actually started out as a live event. So
oh,
what
nice.
We did was, so we took about 600 or 700 people, and everybody was grouped in teams of six. We put them on a 200-acre campground that we actually turned into a living crime scene. And so when we launched Hunt a Killer, you know, we were looking across the landscape, and we said, they had interactive theater, kind of like the Broadway or off-Broadway Sleep No More. And then escape rooms and adventure races. And so we kind of put these three things together and then skinned it with this immersive game where people can kind of be their own detective and work as a team to figure out who done it.
You there, Mike?
Wow, that's I'm still here. I mean, that's so much information. Like right off the bat, like as we were talking with your publicist Lindsay, she was saying you developed the game while you were actively in the military. No, I mean, I just looked at like the first part of the game just over the weekend with my girlfriend, and I couldn't believe all the pieces just from that. How do you come up with such a detailed kind of philosophy of a game in a place like in the military?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think the only time my quote unquote kind of gaming skills ever came into play was probably more the live events. One of the trainings that I had done a long time ago was called SEER School. And it's where the military has done this amazing job of being able to break reality and make you think that you're actually in a situation. So for that, it's more of a hostage situation, and you have to kind of figure out one, how to survive off the land, how to evade, how to resist once you are rolled up and captured, and then ultimately how to escape. But as far as everything outside of that, I've got an amazing business partner. He's super creative. So if I'm kind of the business side, he is most certainly the developer, the story, the creative, the game. So I would say probably about 1 or 2% of what's actually involved in the game comes from me, and the majority comes from his brilliance.
So let's talk about that, the business aspect of it. When did you guys go from, hey, we have this idea, like you said, you started out live action and whatnot, and when did you actually narrow that down and be able to develop that into a profitable business?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what we realized very early with the live event is that as much success as we had off of it, the problem was the amount of resources that had to go into it. And so my partner, because I was still in the military at the time, so I was promoting it and trying to get more participants. But for a solid 6 months, he put the game design and the story and all this stuff together to be able to execute this first event. And so what we quickly realized is that six months of effort to turn this venue into a 200-acre living crime scene to bring 600 people out wasn't necessarily a viable business. And so I think it was maybe about 2 or 3 weeks. This was October, I think October 21st of 2016. So we were 2 or 3 weeks past the event, and we pivoted the business. And so probably about 2 or 3 months prior to the first event, we had decided that, you know, what if we could roll up this experience that we're doing right now where we bring all these people together, and we bring them together more in a community digitally via different online means, but we deliver this to people's doorsteps each month. And so that's when, you know, it was more of a question of which business could scale and which business would be more viable. And so that's when we realized that we were going to get into the monthly delivery business.
So let's talk a little bit about from those early beginnings. How much would you say from your first couple of goes with the live events and as you transition to the home games, how much did you have to tweak it where maybe it was too easy, too hard, some things people didn't get? What was the evolution from the beginning?
Yeah, that's it has certainly evolved. From an event standpoint, you know, we couldn't necessarily test it. You know, we were bringing everybody to the events. I think it was October 1st of 2016. And there was no real way to test all of the different things. So what we did was, there were some things that were very easy. There were some things that were kind of medium level of difficulty. And there were some things that were extremely hard. But what we made sure is that you weren't necessarily missing out on anything based upon, you know, which kind of level you could go to. And how we've done it kind of the same way with the subscription business. But what we've done extremely well is that we've been able to take feedback. So from the event, it was one and done. So if we nailed it, great. If we didn't, but with the subscription business, it's been great because we've been able to evolve the experience based upon feedback that we've collected over the past 24 months. And so there's been quite an evolution, and I think it's only gotten better since the first day that we launched.
Now, what do you think it is about these interactive experiences that you see? You know, more like, for instance, one time for a podcast, me and Mike went LARPing. We contacted a LARP group. We got dressed up in knights outfits, and we got basically our ass handed to us in a big battle. But it was very interesting, and they had a couple hundred members come out for a weekend. And it's pretty fascinating to talk to all the different backgrounds of people, you know, where they came from. Some were young kids in college. Other kids, guys were old guys who run businesses on the side, and they have an average work day, and they come out and they're an elf on the weekend. What do you think it is about these these interactive games and these? You see all sorts of things popping up like this. What do you think is capturing the imagination of people?
Yeah, I think. I mean, and there's certainly been an evolution. We've been in the live event business for probably about 8 years now.
Have you LARPed?
I think we haven't LARPed, but we actually, funny enough, I think we actually brought on at least one kind of LARP advisor to the live event, the first Hunt the Killer. Yeah, so I mean, we had a at least one LARP. We had a couple escape room owners, and so we brought this team together so that we could really kind of figure it out before launching.
That's not the title you want to put on your resume, the LARP advisor.
Yeah, but I think, you know, ultimately experiences truly are the only thing that appreciate over time, right? So when people go out and they invest in, you know, something as simple as a movie or something as extravagant as, you know, a cruise or something like that, like experiences are the only thing you look back on.
Yep.
And they really appreciate and give meaning and purpose to your life. And so, you know, I think that's what you're kind of seeing is that especially the millennial generation, but everybody's now realizing that, like, they just want to experience life. And so that's something that, you know, yes, we're a story. Yes, we're delivered each month. But at the end of the day, like, we are an experiential company. And that's what we're very mindful of. And that's where, you know, we kind of see our core competency. And so when we think about Hunt the Killer and the different genres that we're releasing, you know, first and foremost, it's how do we bring these communities together, and how do we bring these like-minded people together to where they can enjoy this, you know, together and work through it and just have the experience of a lifetime. And, you know, I really think that's probably what you're seeing. And same thing with LARPing. I mean, it's in a form of escapism. There's a lot of people that go to work Monday through Friday who don't necessarily enjoy their jobs as much as the Hunt the Killer folk.
Yeah.
And this is a way for them to kind of break through that reality and get into something that interests them.
Well, let's talk about that real quick. Let's talk about the actual game itself. So, you know, the idea sounds awesome. You know, you were nice enough to send us. I'm actually holding the package right now. I'm kind of was looking at it today, and there's all sorts of things in there, pads and pins and letters and things to read. Mm. What can a person like kind of expect? Like, if you could give them like a synopsis of what they would have to do and what kind of time goes into it. So, like, because it sounds great, but like what exactly am I doing if I start Hunt the Killer today? I get my package. Where do I go from there?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think this kind of goes back to your earlier question of like level of difficulty and how we figure that out. And it really goes to like how we built the experience. And so someone that's investing an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours each month can have just as much fun as other people who are investing 30, 40 hours each month into this experience. And we built it so that you can go way down deep into different layers of the story. And we've created it that way across all levels. We'll have kind of this equal experience. But as far as expectations, like really what we've done is we've created this universe. And kind of our objective is to break the reality for people that have entered the universe so they can't tell when they've actually entered and when they're actually leaving. And so when you get your package, I know you talked about, you probably got a booklet in your first package. You probably got a lapel mm-hmm. pin.
Yep.
And that's from the brand. So that's from Hunt the Killer. And, you know, that's our appreciation. We're kind of giving you tools and different things where you can kind of, you know, show your badge and let the world know you're part of this community. But inside the manila envelope is when you enter the universe. And so one thing that you'll realize is that on the manila envelope, it says Listening Friends of America. And so if you go to listeningfriendsofamerica.org, you'll realize that this is this nonprofit organization that exists to facilitate communications, almost like a pen pal relationship between people who are seeking pen pals and then the volunteers, which that's what you just became, as a volunteer to listen to this pen pal. But what you don't know is, you know, this pen pal may have different things to tell you about the cases and murders and different mysteries that have gone unsolved. And it's your job to really kind of become his pen pal, listen, and work your way through the investigation and figure it out.
Now, one thing this game really does, I mean, as I went through like the beginner video, it talks about, you know, not only researching stuff, but also working with the community. The game has its own forum for people to talk to. Now, as great as it is to bring people in, there's always the scare of somebody out there just to spoil stuff. How do you combat that kind of helping versus ruining a game, if you will?
No, that's a great question. And that's really kind of goes back to the evolution of what we've had to do over the past 24 months. You know, nothing like Hunt the Killer existed before we launched, and there's not much out there like it still. And so we've learned a lot as we've continued to go. And one of the big things, I think it was maybe about a year ago, we were looking at our customer feedback. We were looking at churn and some other different KPIs. And what we realized is that we had a problem. And when we dug deeper, we realized that people were spoiling it because they were searching for websites that existed within the universe, but it was taking them to spoiler sites. And so, you know, there's one type of person out there that goes and they search for the spoilers, and they might find satisfaction, and that's great, and they should have that right. But there's other people out there that are just searching for different things in the universe and then stumble across these sites, and it spoils the entire game for them. And so what we actually had to do in January of this year is we completely reset the starting point. So we were, I think, 3 or 4 seasons into the experience. And basically what we did was we just created a new starting point and then leapfrogged everybody into the new season. And what we've done is we've taken all that data that we've collected over, since starting this thing, and we've kind of built this, we've built the experience or this season that people are working through now in a way that it's harder to spoil for themselves. So, for instance, we used to use this article that linked to the Baltimore Sun, and when people would search it out, eventually the Baltimore Sun put it under a locked page. And then when people would search it out, it would take them to a spoiler site. And so we got rid of some of those things, and we've really kind of built our own, we've built more into our own universe to kind of control that spoiler.
Now let's talk about what goes into to making one. So everybody's getting if they're subscribed, right, they get it once per month. What goes into creating it? Do you have a staff of writers, a staff of voice actors? What kind of work goes on behind the scenes to keep this? Obviously, it's an ongoing thing, so you need ongoing creativity and whatnot. So what kind of staff do you guys rely on?
Yeah, it's you nailed it. We have a whole staff of writers and creatives and graphic designers. And I would argue that they're probably the best in the world. They've been able to create this experience from scratch, learn as they go, and really just blow it out of the park. And so right now we have somewhere between 5 and 6 writers on staff, and 2 graphic designers, and we have some editors, some what else do we have? Some copy editors. So as far as just the creative side, that's certainly the biggest part of our team, and they're all out of our Baltimore headquarters.
Nice. Now, I know some of it says that it's tied into like real cases and things like that. Now, how does that work? Like, if it's tied into real things, but yet people are looking for, you know, solutions, how is it not out there already? Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah, sure. And I think I'd have to see exactly where we refer to this. But I think, in essence, there's a lot of inspiration that comes from real cases. So if you look at kind of your different narrators, so what happens each season is that you change narrators. And your narrator has kind of a very specific voice, a very specific vibe. And there's been a lot of character development that has gone into that narrator. And there's a lot of inspiration from real life serial killers and other people out there, that kind of mold the journey for us. We don't necessarily use like real specific cases.
Okay.
And we're very cognizant of that, but there's a lot of inspiration that comes from real events.
Now, do you play the game itself? And have you ever got to a point where you just went up to your writers and be like, Jim, just tell me where it is. What is it? Is it on this site?
I'm proud to say that I'm the longest subscriber of Hunt the Killer. But the other thing that goes into this is that I do so much traveling. I just recently got out of the military. I separated last October and moved to Baltimore and been running it full time out of there. But there's just so much going on in my life right now that I don't have an enormous amount of time to jump in. So I have a large amount of trust in the creatives and the feedback loop system and their ability to create just this amazing immersive experience. I dig into them when I get a free chance, but I do have behind the scenes on most of the stuff. So instead of asking for the website, I'll just break into the website and figure out what it is.
Now let's talk. Like, I feel like every month I discover or hear, like, I'm a pretty large consumer of podcasts, I would say. You know, it's primarily what I listen to during the week, and I hear you guys and just so many. Every month, something surprised me with another like monthly delivery type service, or where you're like, "Wow! Like, how did I not think of this? Like, this is brilliant! Like, where it's cutting out any middlemen, where it's coming directly to you. Where did you like, do you guys, how it goes into, like, for instance, when I opened that package, there was a pocket watch looking thing and a pin and what goes into kind of putting all those boxes together and having, you know, enough and getting, if you have to get something made and whatnot, like, how many months ahead are you guys?
Yeah. So that all is rapidly changing. at this point, we're seasons ahead. We used to literally write this thing on the spot. So, you know, before you got, if you were all the way at the end, so like, for instance, I'm currently at the end. I think there's only maybe 8 or 10 of us left in that very original cohort. So we started out October 2016. I think there was like 30 of us. Now there's 10 of us left. So we're as far in advance as you can get. And we used to actually write that episode the month prior, and then we would be sourcing and trying to find all the different items and sending things off to the printer days in advance. And then everything would come together at one time and we'd ship it out. The problem is that the first thing is that we're shipping in the ballpark of 40,000 packages a month. And so being able to last minute source all this stuff, bring it all in, and then put 40,000 packages together in 11 days and ship them out, I'm sure you can see where the problem in that lies. So we've got a warehouse about 6,000 square feet. We've got probably between 15 and 20 people. We call them storytellers, and they are in there every single day packing these. And then we have kind of the front of house operations folks who are out there sourcing, you know, working with printers. We actually bought our own commercial printer. So now we've essentially turned into a commercial printing house as well. But yeah, there's a lot that goes in behind the scenes, and certainly the second largest team at Hunt the Killer is the operations team.
Wow. He's got a heck of a lineup at his place. You know, he's got storytellers, he's got LARP experts. And all. Is somebody just a manager there?
No, we don't have time for managers. Everybody just focuses on their area and plugs away. But no, we've been very fortunate to this point, getting to where we're at. It's been a long time in the making. I know we're just starting out to really, really get out there into the mainstream. Everybody has put in a lot of work to get to this point. So extremely proud of them.
So what's the overall goal for the company? Do you plan on just continuing the Hunt a Killer series? Do you see yourself expanding to some kind of other different series or mystery? What's the overall goal for the company?
Yeah, there's quite a few things we're working on. And the first thing is probably about 6 months after launching Hunt a Killer, some of the feedback we got is hey, I want one box and I want it all self-contained. And so we started launching these premium subscriptions in 2017, and they've been working very well. So, for instance, we're working on a premium now. I think we still have 4 of them out there right now. But we're about to launch a premium in, I think, November, late November, early December, just in time for the holidays. And it's put together by one of the writers behind Unsolved Mysteries. And so, like, what we've done is we've taken these episodic stories, and we've turned it into a single delivery. It comes to your box. It has a solution set in it. In addition to the premiums, the other things we do, we started getting into other genres. And so we launched a subscription called Empty Faces. And so Empty Faces is a horror subscription. And so it uses the same sort of methodology and principles that Hunt the Killer uses. But instead of solving a case, you're trying to figure out what's going on kind of on the other side. There's a lot of different scary and horror things happening in that story. And so we've got one more in the pipeline that I think releases in 3 months, and it's going to be a sci-fi box. But where we see kind of the biggest opportunity at this point for our company is that we are immersive storytellers. So like we've kind of put our flag in the ground as great storytellers. And so what we're seeing that translate into is audio. And so right now we have 3 different audio dramas, podcasts that are in production. And then we have about 3 or 4 different hosted podcasts that we're currently working on. So, you know, where do we see the future? We love subscription boxes. We'll never, we'll never get out of it. But, we see tremendous opportunity into telling great stories and via audio.
I mean, the whole thing really does sound, you know, like, it's just a tremendous idea, and it's really cool, like,
you know, I'm sure where it came from with a conversation it started from one day, to think that you have, you know, 40,000 subscribers or whatnot. It's pretty amazing, and I think it's just a really cool story. So if people want to check out Hunt the Killer or start Hunt the Killer, what, first off, how much does it cost them, and where should they go to kind of check this out?
Sure. So you go to huntthekiller.com, and you apply for membership. And I think currently we're accepting about 200 a day. We're still kind of going back to your point of how do we pull all this together in the operations team. We're still trying to control demand to make sure that we can fulfill on the promises that we put out there. And so you go to huntthekiller.com, you apply for membership. If you're accepted into membership, you have the opportunity to choose between three different packages. And so there's I think, a two-season package, a one-season package, and then there's a month-to-month. And it starts at about $25 a month.
Now, I got to ask you, everything about this game, I mean, I'm just preliminary looking at it. It's great, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. But I got to ask you, when you describe to people about what you do in the game, what bad joke do you hear more? A, did the butler do it, or B, did Colonel Mustard do it, the lead pipe and the conservatory? Which one?
Definitely the latter one. our community is like, they are diehards and they are into this. And so like they boil it down to every single detail. And so like they want to get that detailed oriented as far as like who did it, why did they do it? And they're really kind of breaking down the to like a psychological level. And I mean, every day I'm impressed when I log into the community and see the conversations that are happening. I'm blown away.
That's awesome, man. Ryan, I want to thank you so much for giving us some time, and we wish you the best of luck. Obviously, you're on the definitely on the right path with this game. You know, thanks for giving us a couple minutes.
No problem. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm going to pay him money, so one of the episodes, everything will just trace back to you.
God, there's like 200 people on my front lawn. They got pitchforks, and they say something like, "Where's Sarah?" I don't get this right now.
Scott, plus side is we got a lot of new subscribers. Bad side is everyone thinks I'm a murderer. All right, Mike, it's time for a guest. It's time for a guest.
What we got, Scott?
What we got? I'm pretty excited about this one. This one it keeps with our random people motif for sure. But me and you are both big fans of Always Sunny. What's funny is when we did the Sandy Martin and Scott Cummings interview, Greg Cummings interview, which was Mac and Mac's parents, both in the show. We joined like these Always Sunny groups to try to promote the podcast and whatnot. And he had actually commented on something, and that's how I reached out to him. So from the McPoyle family, in arguably one of the best episodes of that show, possibly ever. It's one of my favorites, where they try out for the Eagles in season 3-4. Did I lose Mike? Maybe I lost Mike, but
yeah, there you are. You're back.
Oh, you're back. No, you're back. You're back.
Whatever.
But I was gonna say,
how was the interview?
Yeah, I was gonna say arguably one of the best episodes of that show, when they try out for the Eagles, season 3 or 4. Four, I think.
Season 4, I think it's called The Gang Gets Invincible.
Yeah, from the movie, the movie Invincible, but. The brother of the McPoyles, Doyle McPoyle, Bob Rush, who was also Skeeter in Always Sunny, which was a show. I mean, Skeeter in Sons of Anarchy, which is a show I watched kind of all the way through. So, without further ado, let's get Bob Rush on the line.
Scott, Mike, how you doing, guys?
Beautiful, Bob. Thank you. Thank you so much for giving us a few minutes here, and it's good hooking up with you.
Yeah, appreciate it. My pleasure.
Yeah, so the way I looked, you know, I even found your name you know, we're me and my both Mike and I are big Always Sunny fans. Yep. So you obviously have the designation of being in the McPoyle family. Like, that's got to be like that should be top of the resume here. First off, how did you get hooked up with doing that job? And for everyone who doesn't know, it's Doyle.
Yeah, I was in L.A. for quite a long time working as an actor. And I got called into the casting office for Wendy O'Brien. I think I just met one of her assistants at a workshop. It's kind of a taboo word now in L.A. I guess you can't do those anymore. But I was a member of a really great workshop out in L.A. for actors to meet casting directors. And he saw me. And I think like a month or so after that, that breakdown came out. And they actually called my agent. And he remembered me, brought me in. Yeah, I guess they're looking for like large inbred looking guys. And his light bulb went off in his head like, hey, Bob Rush, inbred, large, we can get this guy. So I went in, and luckily I was a fan of the show. I caught it in season one. And I think it was the first episode I saw was the first one with the McPoyles when they set up the gym teacher or something or something, if I recall, for molestation for Charlie.
Yeah.
And I was hooked, you know, gym teacher's molestation. I was like, hey, I'm in. This is a great show. And then I remember reading they got Dane DeVito signed on. So I was really excited for them. And then I just happened to meet her assistant at this workshop and said, we cast Sunny in Philadelphia. And I was like, hey, great show. And next thing I know, I'm auditioning for it. And I knew exactly who they were. I knew about the unibrow. I believe I even took a little, I'm trying to remember if I took a little mascara and made a unibrow or not. I can't remember. But I remember just coming in. I had a headband on and cut off like a sweatshirt. I looked very Rocky Balboa-ish in Philadelphia. And just kind of did the thing. I was in really good shape at the time. I was training as a boxer for a play I was doing. And also, so I was in getting in really good shape. I was pretty lean and big and came in and did my thing and they liked it. So, there you go.
Were you like method acting, like drinking milk leading up to this, like daily?
I was drinking warm milk and eating lots of fish. I slept with my sister. It was really good method acting.
Gotcha.
And I need to apologize to her, by the way, to this day. I do owe her an apology or something. I remember it was the bus scene when they first met Doyle. It was that little speech about, you know, and I'm, what was that? What do you say? Something about, you little bad, you're sad, pitiful life. And I'll be on Eagles line. And that was a little Doyle voice there, if I recall. And, did the thing. And, I remember they go, at the end of the audition, the casting director goes, and Bob, how tall are you? And I go 6'2", 240 pounds. And I gave him the flex. Hogan, Hulk Hogan style, and gave him a little grunt, and they seemed to like that. So next thing I thought it was a pre-call. I thought they were going to call me back, like, for the director. And next thing I know, I got a call a few days later and said, hey, I got the role. I'm like, oh, great. And Fred Savage directed it, and that was kind of cool. So, yeah.
Now, when we talked to a couple other, we were lucky enough to talk to Max, Dad, and Mom on this show, and they talked about how those guys are just always like ad-libbing and just improvising like crazy. Was it the same experience for you?
Not in my scenes with them. I remember the back and forth with me and I believe, not Dennis, Mac. You are kind of that kind of carried on a little bit more than the script said, but I remember the scene that was really funny was when they met Donovan McNabb, and that was my buddy Jeffrey Owen, and he was at that workshop actually too, if I recall. We were both members of this group called Real Pros Workshops, and he was there, and he played the son-in-law on the Cosby Show. He's a great guy. And so I remember when I saw that, I read the script and I saw that, and I don't think I knew it was going to be him. When I saw him and I said, who are you playing? He goes, I'm playing imitation Donovan McNabb. I started laughing. I'm like, this is going to be great. And they really asked him, they said, hey, do you mind if we throw in that you were Alvin on the Cosby Show? And he just joked and said, yeah, go ahead. He didn't care. And him and Faison Love, improvised a little bit when he pulled up or something about the car or something. And then they just kept, when he came up, they just kept improvising stuff, and he just took it like a champ. It was a lot of fun.
That's hilarious.
So they get you ready. Not so much. Healthy breakfast at McDonald's.
Breakfast at McDonald's, and yeah, he goes McDonald's loving it or something. Yeah.
Now you, you look. I pull up your, you know, your IMDb, and you've been in a lot of different things. Everything from Sons of Anarchy. You had the role of Skeeter, and but you go,
Skeeter.
All different things. A lot of shows that a lot of people would know. Two and a Half Men and Desperate Housewives, and Bones, and where did your acting career start? Were you always, always on the path to try to become an actor, or was this to find you later in life? When did you get your start?
I was a kid. I was kind of a hyper little spaz, and I was not a good athlete. I was not a good student. But I was really good at making people laugh. And that was kind of my thing. And so at an early age, I remember getting in trouble a lot for always talking in class. And it was really just me trying to make friends, trying to entertain the other kids, you know. So I, in sixth grade, my mom, a light bulb kind of went off. And she actually in fifth grade did my first play kind of on a dare just to piss off a neighbor kid of mine who was in a play. So it was kind of one of those things where me and my friend were like, you know, he's like, I'm in this play. We're like, well, we could do that. No, he can't. Yeah, we could. No, he can't. Yeah, we could. And you show up to high school the next day, and the director put us in Peter Pan. We're both tall, so he made us pirates, and the kids started crying when he showed rehearsal, so it was kind of nice. After that, I was hooked. I made a kid cry, and I was, you know, whatever. It was a lot of fun. I liked the attention it gave me. So the next year, my mom had me take acting lessons and just fun little things and, like, exercises and stuff and skits and whatnot, and we did that, and I was hooked. And kept tinkering with it. And then luckily my high school, I'm from a small town near Buffalo called Dunkirk, New York. And we had a really good high school program for theater. So I got to high school. I really got involved and just kept progressing up the ladder and doing bigger and bigger roles as it went on. And then my senior year came around, and I was also a pretty accomplished drummer. And, I was kind of like, well, I would have had a probably better chance of being a drummer, because I got, you know, was more recognized for that, I guess. And, I kind of thought to myself, I can keep playing drums, but I really can't just keep acting. At least I didn't think I could. So I auditioned for a BFA program and for college just to see what would happen. And I got in, and it was a pretty good program in Ohio at the time called Wright State University. So there you go. So I went to school there my freshman year, stayed there for 1 year, realized I'm paying way too much out-of-state tuition. And then I transferred back to the Buffalo, New York area. And ended up graduating from Buffalo State College, and went out to lived in Chicago for 5 years, and went to L.A. after that, spent 15 and a half years there. And almost 3 years ago, I moved back to the Buffalo area. I'm now looking to be more of a producer, writer, and actor. I still act. And I have a studio here where I teach downtown Buffalo. So it's been pretty crazy ride, you know?
Yeah, I was noticing on there that, with as you were talking about more producing, Ryan, I see you did a little short called The Man's Game. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and what are your thoughts on your first work, if you will, being out there?
Yeah, Man's Game was a short film that me and my buddy James Sharp wrote. And it was, at the time, I think I saw something at ESPN about something about gay men in professional sports. And it was kind of like, I'd call it a witch hunt or something going on, it seemed. And I just kind of thought, my God, what a life that would be for me, you know, to be gay and be like a professional football player and having to hide that every day. And that's what that was about. It was called Man's Game. And I kind of got that from the sportscaster, Jim Rome, who every time it was like about football, he wanted to, it was a big hit or something, he yelled, "Man's Game." And I remember that title, that thing. And so I wrote this with James, a short, and I was we shot it back in 2013 and came out like in 2014, and with the idea that we were going to try to make it into a feature film, which never happened. I think I was a little too old by that point to play a freshman football player anyway, so did that. And that was really interesting. And then so happens to be that James co-wrote the script I'm right now shopping for investors as well. He's a good friend of mine, and he's going to be directing it. It's a feature film called Demolition Dance. And it's interesting. It's very different than the acting. I mean, the acting, I show up, I do my thing, I study a character, and I make some choices and show up. Where producing and writing, it's like it's your baby. You know, you're right. So much more involved. I produced a lot of theater out in L.A. too. I had a theater company out there for 10 years called Sky Pilot Theater Company. And the second five of those years, we did all original plays too, which was very intriguing. We had our own playwright wing. So I was working with playwrights from day one, you know, developing new work. So that was a lot of fun. But man, I tell you what, film is a whole different ballgame. And just trying to get people to give you money. anything you do, please, dear God, give me money, I'll make a film. But
right, that kind of leads into the question I want. So, you know, it looks like you've done everything from, you know, male jogger, you know, to drunk man,
yeah.
You know, all these funny names, man number one in number, you know, like, to other roles and good shows. So, like, were you were you the starving artist that we hear of that did a million different things, or did you just kind of take acting as it came to you?
I was never really starving. I mean, can't be over 250 pounds and consider yourself starving. So
metaphorically really
starving artist, as they say. Yeah, metaphorically. Yeah, I mean, luckily most of my time in L.A., I always had like a day job, bartending or something like that. So I always had enough money. So I think the desperation factor wasn't there for me. I think I tell a lot of young actors that. I said, listen, make sure you have some money coming in somehow so you're not desperate. Because even if you don't realize it, that, you know, that comes across when you're working. You need the job. And I think it's important not to have that. So I just, you know, I took, for me, it was accepting my essence. It took me a long time to realize who I thought I was going to play compared to what other people thought I should play. And I think a lot of actors go through that. I remember like early on in high school and then college, I kind of had this chip on my shoulder because, well, why can't I be a leading man? Well, I'm ugly. First of all, that doesn't help. Big and ugly, you know, in my own charming kind of way, but, and then later, years later, I'll tell you this great story. I did a play back in 2006, the David Mamet famous play called Sexual Perversity in Chicago. I did that play with my theater company, and a buddy of mine came to see it. And like a week later, he came to the bar where I was working at, and it was a little quiet. He said, hey, I wanted to say I really enjoyed the show. He goes, you're really fun to watch. I said, well, thank you. I really appreciate that. He goes, you have a thing going on where it's really hard not to watch you because you're a little off center, my man. You know that, right? And I remember thinking to myself, what the hell are you saying? You know, I'm a little offended, to be honest with you. And you could tell. He goes, no. He goes, that's a good thing. He was an older actor, by the way. He had a lot of, you know, experience, and a lot of work under his belt. He goes, that's a good thing. He goes, because you can't buy that. And then kind of a light bulb went off. Like, oh, okay. So instead of, you know, I always kind of realized right after that I'm not really, I can play the dad or the neighbor, but my dad neighbor tends to have a secret. that's the interesting part of it. And sure enough, like a year later, I booked Sonny in Philadelphia, and I would happen to, you might agree, Doyle's a little off center. And
just a bit.
And yeah, a little bit. And then later on, Skeeter from Sons of Anarchy, which same thing. So I don't fight it. Just go with it. You know, whatever they give me, I do my own thing and make the character my own. And I think the casting directors and people I work with tend to appreciate that, because I'd always be the guy brought in for a role I had no shot of getting. It happened all the time. I'd be the one type that was so different than the rest of the room. But it was because I had a good relationship with the casting director who liked me. Like, as a compliment. I was kind of the, well, let's see what Bob Rush would do with this role.
So you and Zac Efron would get the same auditions?
Honestly, I remember one time I was like the only white guy there. It was like one of those things where like, Bob, I was a token white guy. And like, okay, there you go. You know, sure, Bob, you play this. Or I'd be like just a different complete size. Yeah, like a bunch of pretty boys and me. Or guys who were like 20 years older or 15 years younger than me. And it was just, you know, it wasted a lot of time and gas driving all around Southern California for auditions. But, you know, the one time it paid off was Sons of Anarchy. I kind of saw that character as kind of a more of a skinny little tweaky dude. If you ever saw the show, Skeeter had a nervousness about him. And I got to the audition, and guess what? It was a room full of skinny little tweaky dudes and me. And I went in there and just did my thing and made the character my own. And at the end of the day, they really had no other choice but me, it seemed, because of that. They had no one else to cast because he liked what he did with it and, you know, and my look. So the one time it paid off, it was well worth it.
You've done a lot of different roles. I mean, a lot of people can look at it as a success with the different shows you've been on and so forth. When you talk to a young actor, do you almost have to show to them, like, you know, a good time or a good acting doesn't have to be the person who's making the $20 million in the blockbuster movie, or do you get a lot of pushback where it's like, no, I'm going to be the lead. I'm going to do it. I'm moving from Buffalo to L.A. and it's going to happen.
I think the first rule I tell them is love what you do. Develop a love for this thing we do called acting and the craft, if you want to call it that. I think that was my mistake. I think early in my 20s, I kind of had a chip on my shoulder because when I graduated college, I really didn't have a lot of support, I felt, from the administration, people teaching me, except for one gentleman. But the other ones, I kind of felt like I was kind of pushed aside, like I really wouldn't succeed because, you know, I enjoyed having a good time, having a few beers, and I wasn't really the artist type, it seemed. And so I had a chip on my shoulder, and I realized later on when I got to about 30-ish or late 20s, when I finally got rid of that chip and I really developed a love for what I did is when everything started working for me. I started getting it, and success slowly started coming, you know, and happiness, more importantly, of, you know, and these great memories I have now when I got rid of that chip. So I think I tell them, a lot of people, they want to be, I sense when they talk to me about like coming to an acting studio and learning, they want to be famous. And I tell them, if you want to be famous, go rob a bank and you'll be famous, I promise you. But, you know, if you want to be good and you want to really be good at what you do and be respected, get some training and see if you love doing this. If you don't love it, absolutely love it, don't do it, because it is tough. It's a tough business. I think it's like less than 10% of people in my union, SAG-AFTRA, make a living at it. I think maybe less than 5. So it's not easy. I mean, I'm back here in Buffalo, New York, and I'm trying other things with, like I said, producing and stuff. But I love to act. And when I teach my students, and I get really excited for them, you know, and I see them do well. And sometimes I'll get up and I'll improvise with them or something just to, you know, make a point or show something. And, you know, I don't get a lot of chances to act right now. So I really get excited to do it. And I think you got to have that love for this, you know, at the end of the day, because why else would you want to do this? In all other reasoning for this career, it sucks as far as the hardship and the letdown and whatnot and the peaks and valleys of a career. It's tough.
Right.
And it's not for everybody. But, you know, if you don't love it, at the end of the day, you can't look at it and go, man, yeah, I might have gone out that last 99 times and failed, but that 100th time I went out and I booked that role, or what great memories I have from that experience. And I did that play that one time, and not a lot of people saw it. It was a small storefront theater, but God, it was a bunch of great actors out there with me, and we did a great job at the, you know, and what a beautiful play. And that critic from the LA Weekly came and saw it and loved it, and blah, 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 blah. You know, those are memories. You can't buy that, you know? So love what you do is my advice to them.
Right. So we were talking about Sons of Anarchy before. I wanted to get into that a little bit. What was, you know,
Sons, yep.
you had a couple episodes. You're on a very successful show. Like, in fact, you know, like Sonny and Sons of Anarchy are two series that I have watched every episode of. So you're on. You get the call to be on Sons. What was that filming like? Where that's completely different environment, I would assume, than Sonny, where you're talking about bikes and guns and gangs and you know, maybe a much bigger production value and you know, what was the difference between that and did you enjoy your time doing that?
Yeah, I shot a total of 5 episodes for Sons, and the storyline completely changed, so it was actually 4 over. Well, it was interesting. It was actually Wendy O'Brien again, the casting director, who cast me in Sonny.
Nice.
So got lucky. She's very good to me. Brought me in, and it was like a year later, and I'd probably put on about 15, 20 pounds. I was a little thicker, and just got to do that show. And when I booked it, it was the 2nd episode. So the whole cast and crew were excited because the pilot got picked up. They didn't, they had no idea. So all I can say is there was a lot of testosterone on that set. I remember that. The second episode.
Yeah.
All the guys playing the bikers. Yeah. We're really a lot of punching each other in the arm and back and forth and a lot of wrestling and stuff like that. And it was a very different show. When I came in the season, it was season 3 for Sonny by the time I got there.
Right.
And they kind of, they had it set. They were, and then DeVito had joined. So they were doing well. And it was much more laid back. And it was comedy, obviously. It was comedy compared to a drama. So I think that affects the entire atmosphere of the cast and crew. So, it was a much more serious, I don't want to say serious, because they were funny. The guys were all really cool on Sons and had a, but. It definitely, there was a darkness to that show, obviously, and I think that it just kind of was everywhere on that set, if I can recall. And it was in a cool way, though. I think, and I kind of remember thinking this is going to be a pretty cool show. I read the script, and I was like, it's interesting. Because at the time, you couldn't have seen it, hadn't shown yet. So we picked up the vibe that Kurt Sutter and his crew were going after right away. And as an actor, I really appreciated that. That really, the script really jumped off the page. I remember, like, wow, this is something very different than I had never seen before. And then all of a sudden, a few years later, I get the call, season 4, they call me back, and I was on an episode. And then season 5, they brought back like 3 times. And they sure mentioned me a lot. I wish I could have got something every time they mentioned me. call Skeeter. Skeeter will take care of it. Hey, it looks like we got to call Skeeter for this one. Like, come on, man.
Well, guys, I got to make friends. Throw my name in there for fun.
Right. Exactly. I could show up and just, here I am. I'll pick up the body. What is all you doing? So,
now, as you've been doing it in this business for a while now, and now, like you said, you're looking more writing and producing. What kind of stuff are you looking into? What excites you more? Are you looking light-hearted comedy, drama? What gets your brain moving where you're like, yeah, that'd be awesome?
Rom-coms. Lots of rom-coms.
I just like a good story. At the end of the day, a good story that maybe we've seen before, because I think everything's been done to death at this point now. So a good story with a little twist, that's something we haven't seen before. The script I'm selling now is at the end of the day, it's about demolition derbies, but it's a family story about this family and love and for each other. And that's what intrigues me. If I read something really, really that jumps off the page and I can identify with. I think a broad number of people out there would also jump on it as well. I think I have a good idea what people enjoy. I hope I do. And so that's what steps are. Really just a really good story. I get bored real easily. And so I'm on page 10. If something's just not clicking, I stop reading it. But, good storytelling. I think from the days of cavemen writing stuff on a wall to now, just anybody can tell a good story, you got it. So Yep. I guess that's my answer. Mm. Good story.
Now, Bob, I want to thank you one for giving us some time, and you know, I got a couple things here. One, will we ever see Doyle McPoyle again?
I have no idea. I kind of figured since that was 11 years ago.
Yeah.
And
you never know.
Back to the wedding episode, I kind of figured that was never going to happen. I figured, listen, I get it. They needed somebody to bring the McPoyle family to the football tryout.
Yes.
Doyle was the guy. And that would be about it. And sure enough, I've never been brought back. It's fine. I still enjoy the show. I'm still a fan of the show.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I get it. But, you know. I mean, it'd be nice. I always thought it'd be a nice revenge episode or something. Maybe Doyle now has a brace on his leg. It could be like a Jason Voorhees thing coming over and clicking the leg or something.
I like it.
Like shocking people on the click, click, click of the brace of the leg. And there's Doyle all leather face or Jason Voorhees out, you know. So I'd have to drop a little weight to get back in Doyle shape, but I could do that pretty quickly, you know.
I think he was referenced in season 11, too, in the court case, if I recall.
Someone told me that. I didn't see the episode or something. I guess they said something about Doyle now owns a fur shop or something. Someone told me that.
Yeah.
I missed that episode. I'm like, I could see that. Ironically, now, I have a lot of friends who are fur trappers up here outside of Buffalo, so I kind of know about furs, to be honest with you. So.
Now, the other two things before we go. One, where can people go check you out and go check out your work or get in touch with you? And two, on your IMDb thing bio, it says that you're an uncle to over 45 nephews and nieces. Is that real?
Yeah. Yeah.
45?
It just went to 49 since that was written. Wow. I got to change that. Thanks for reminding me. Yeah,
Christmas suck.
I get to see one of the newest ones, my little nephew, great nephew Lucas, this weekend. I can't wait. I'm the youngest of seven kids, and I was the great mistake by the lake. I always call myself on Lake Erie. My mom was 41, my dad was 46 when I was born, so I was Bobby. Whoops. the closest sibling next to me was 8.5 years older, so there's a 19 year gap between my oldest brother and me. So I've never had kids as far as I know. So, I was an uncle when I was 9 and it's never ended. And they used to keep having more and more. Yeah. I'm watching at 49 now. Yeah. Yeah.
Could you name them all?
Uncle. No, no, I can name all my nieces and nephews. Great ones. It's impossible. Don't even ask me about birthdays. I mean, that's ridiculous. You know?
So where can people go check you out?
You know, the best thing right now that I'm most working on right now is my acting studio. It's called Acting Studio 716, the number 716.com. That is my studio in Buffalo where I'm teaching right now. And, you know, there's also a Instagram, Bob Rush Actor, at both Instagram and Twitter. And, of course, Rush is spelled R-U-S-C-H. And there's also, I have a Facebook page as well.
Yep.
So you find me on there. I'm posting stuff on there all the time. Me just being stupid and echoing in a tunnel like yesterday in Delaware Park in Buffalo. So lots of fun things.
One last question. For what I saw on your Twitter, you're a Bills fan. Is it exciting they finally make it back to the playoffs, or is it discouraging that they got rid of Tyrod and now it's almost looking like another rebuild's coming?
I'm excited. I want to say this, though. I was very excited for Philadelphia. One, they beat the Patriots. I hate the Patriots. Two, because of Sonny in Philadelphia, I kind of adopted them as my NFC team. And so I was ecstatic for them. But, yeah, I'm a diehard Buffalo Bills fan. Bills Mafia all the way. You know, hey, man, we can only throw each other through so many tables on fire before we got eventually get to the playoffs. You ever seen YouTube videos, Bills Mafia, I tell my friends, their fans of other teams, oh, we party. I go, just Google Bills Mafia and let me know when you're ready to party with those guys. Dear God. I think, you know, hey, man, nobody expected them to win more than 4 or 5 games last year, and they made the playoffs. So great coach, Sean McDermott. I love the draft class they just got. Josh Allen, I think, you know, in a year or two is going to be something special. who knows right now? I'm just excited for the future of the team. I think they got Bean as the general manager. Tyrod, God bless him. I loved him, but, you know, it just wasn't working out. I mean, his they always said his he never threw interceptions. He never threw the ball. I mean, that was the problem in the coverage. So I'm excited for Josh Allen and who they got, AJ McCarron, coming in this year. I think he's a great kind of bridge quarterback for them. Edmonds, the linebacker, they're going to be looking good. I'm really kind of excited for them. I don't know if they'll be in the playoffs again this year, but I think we got that monkey off our back, which was huge. Have you ever been supporting a team for, you know, 18 years with no playoffs, or 17, 18 years? Just getting to the playoffs gets that monkey off your back. And I really feel now that they're ready to start stepping forward. And I mean, I'm excited. I love Sean McDermott, the coach. I think he's a real deal, and great coaching goes a long way.
That's awesome, man. Bob, thank you so much for giving us a few minutes here, man. We appreciate it. And good luck with whatever projects you got coming up.
Appreciate that, guys. Hey, thanks so much for your time.
But do you want an only Doyle McPoyle, man? We're
very interesting person.
Yeah,
wouldn't think the person who played Doyle McPoyle would be like deep acting, saying I want different things and stuff like that. And you know, you almost stereotype. You see the character is like, all right, that's what he wants to be.
And I think that's what makes them good. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like the sister, like what's her name? Maggie McPoyle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like she doesn't look anything like that character.
No, she's a model.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's
so
insane.
It just shows, you know. So we are picking off one sunny character at a time. So we got Sandy, we got
Max Dad.
Luther. And we got Doyle McPoyle. So where do you stand on so this week we obviously lost another very large celebrity, Anthony Bourdain. I liked Anthony Bourdain. I dug him. I read his book, Kitchen Confidential. I remember my ex, who was a chef, and another chef I knew, were all very into him. They all very much loved him. Very like open, kind of like rock star chef kind of guy. But I really liked his show, like No Reservations. I dug that show. I was always like a fan of those travel shows and whatnot. Even Zane Lamprey, who was a guest on our show, he was the one from Three Sheets and Drinking Made Easy. He was talking about how he had met Anthony Bourdain, and people had called his show like the Anthony Bourdain of booze and whatnot. And he was like, I don't want to be called that, you know, but he put up something today. And I don't know, man. It's definitely sad. Obviously, no one's disputing that, but it's just like, I don't know why this is becoming, maybe just it's covered more that we don't know, but it just seems that all these celebrity deaths are hanging, and they all seem to have some kind of drug ties to them. I mean, my first thought is that, like, a lot of these prescription pills and the drugs today have
maybe screwing with your chemistry.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like the one of the side effects might be these just dark, horrific thoughts that these people can't get over. But I mean, obviously, it's also opening, shining a light on mental illness. But I don't know, man. I thought that was a sad one. Obviously, with Kate Spade too. I didn't know much about Kate Spade, so.
No.
Not to say I was like less sad or whatever. Anytime anyone takes their own life is a, you know, tragedy. But I don't know. What are your thoughts?
It's a hard thing to say. I mean, I think this world we've been a lot more confrontational, probably in the last, I would say, like 8 to 12 years. You know, I mean, everybody. I've heard some on the internet that you immediately point to the Trump thing while everybody's depressed. It's like, all right, God. It's not all him.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not all him. I mean, I mean, if you want to trace it back, I can remember, I mean, if you, not to go to the political side, we'll get back to this, but that goes back when like, Bush got elected for the second time. There was a lot of rumblings like, oh man, he went for the religious vote and stuff like that. But getting to the point,
first off, I don't buy
for a second people killing themselves over who's president. Like, I'm so out of politics. Like, like Mike, you could be president, and if I'm killing myself over that, like, you got to have a bigger purpose in life if that's how close someone's paying attention to that.
No.
But
in the long scheme of things, whatever the president does doesn't really affect us that much. It's more local, and the Senate and the House and all what they vote for on rules and your local government that hurts you more than anything. But in any case, I mean, it's definitely, we have to look at it somewhat as an epidemic, and somebody should be looking at this, because it just seems, I mean, everything death-wise, I mean, it seems the suicides are up. It seems like the shootings are up. It seems like everybody is losing their mind, and their only thought is to take somebody's life, and it just seems more rapid. I mean, we keep on talking about, you know, terrorism. All these things I'm seeing, I mean, it's not the quote-unquote prototypical, you know, assassinations or whatever. It's just some kid goes back to his school. Some celebrity can't deal with something in life and off themselves. It's getting very rampant, and I wish I had kind of a better answer to kind of look at it, but it's definitely something that we should probably get some scientists to look at. Like you said, it could be with all these pills that we're taking nowadays, maybe one of the side effects is it just tears your mind and you get suicidal thoughts. I don't know. Or,
yeah, like, I know, I mean, you know, they say Bourdain was an addict back in the day, and he talked openly mm-hmm. about that, which seems to be one of the common threads between a lot of these celebrity suicides is addiction, right? In the last year, mm-hmm. we lost Cornell, the guy from Linkin Park, you know.
Yeah, Chester Bennington.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Bourdain, blah, 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 so on and so on.
Before that, we had Robin Williams. Yeah, we had quite a few in all the last couple of years.
Which I don't know what that is. I don't even really want to tread on that because I don't really know what that is. Is that the way to go? Is that the easiest way to go? But it's more of like what the hell is going on? One thing it obviously proves is that you could have all the money in the world, you could have the greatest job in the world, and depression and mental illness is obviously still finding these people. It doesn't mm-hmm. hide from anyone. Money's not is not a cure for this. But it is amazing to think that a guy whose job was to go eat and travel the world, who, like, I've heard him on Rogan in past years, like, or like, you know, we got very into jujitsu lately and seemed very like a family man. But his job is to travel the world and eat and film a show. And here he has millions and millions of fans and people that love him. Mm-hmm. That even that is just not enough to combat this illness, these dark thoughts. Obviously, it's just crazy to think about.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if maybe deep down they didn't even really like doing that. I don't know.
I think that too sometimes. Like, you know, that's almost like, hey, I'm good at this, but maybe it doesn't.
Yeah. I was thinking about doing something else. Why do that? You're so good. Here's a TV show. Have fun. All right.
Yeah, here's a couple mil for your family, you know, like.
Yeah, it's a tough call. Like, one person I kind of worry about right now is David Spade, because if you recall, he took Chris Farley's death like really bad. It wasn't a suicide, but I mean, in essence, it was a suicide because he OD'd himself. And then I remember him like talking on Stern how he's like he didn't go to the funeral, and everybody's like, you'll feel better looking at the body. He's like, no, I don't. I'm not gonna feel better looking at the dead body of one of my best friends. I can't do that. And then kind of dealing with the same thing here with his sister-in-law. It's a tough gig. I mean, I don't know what to say. I mean, every time somebody does it, somebody says, you know, it was their life. And in the end, it gets three or four other people kind of thinking about it.
Yeah. And I don't know. I was talking to someone today. I mean, Imagine, God forbid, being in the mental state where you got kids and whatnot, and you're saying to yourself that you being dead is a better solution than you being alive, even to your family. Like not just to yourself, but to people that love you and your immediate family and whatever, and your fans. And so you, in your mind, whatever your mind has done to you, it's better to be dead and get this over with, that whatever you're struggling with, than to fight through it. It's a dark thought to think about.
Yeah, and the sad thing is none of these people gave any signs. Robin Williams gave no signs. Nothing we're hearing from Kate. Anthony, obviously, nobody had a clue. You can at least somewhat say with Chester Bennington, it might have been from Chris Cornell taking his life. But even so, to your point, I remember you put it on Facebook, you couldn't, you know, feel sorry for him after he ends his life with five young kids in his home, you know.
I don't know what feel sorry is the word. It's just, to me, like, I don't know. When you matter to someone that much, like where you're their father or their, you know, or the husband or something, like, you can feel, like, I feel sorry, obviously, that their thoughts were that dark and that horrific. But I also feel sorry that the kids got to go through that for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my grandfather, I learned some. Remember how I was telling you, like, a couple of weeks ago, I had gone to my aunt's house to learn, like, all my family history and stuff like that. I don't even know if we got to talk about that.
It somewhat sounds familiar, but it doesn't sound familiar on the podcast. Yeah. So continue.
Well, you know, my father's just like a, you know, hardworking blue collar guy, and he's just like, you know, he doesn't have all the history of his family. But I have an aunt who, like, she's like a. The historian of the family has all these pictures and boxes and just all these. She knows everything about everything to do with our family. So during the spring, I had met up with her because I wanted to just sit down with her and, like, hear stuff. You know what I mean? Like I feel like if I wait and I wait till everybody's gone, I'm not going to know any of this. And this is, like, the best, you know, like, so it was important. So I went and, like, talked to her and I just found out a bunch of interesting things and, like, cleared up a couple of, like, I know my great aunt, my great uncle married the grandma from the Beverly Hillbillies, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Irene Ryan. I know I had said that before, but it was pretty interesting to hear that. And they had started out, which I thought was kind of interesting. That started as a little radio show, like a little comedy radio show, which you know, is kind of, you know, it's kind of interesting to think, like, hey, we have this stupid little show that we do, and, you know, maybe someday we'll, you know, someone will Google us. But anyway, so I found out that my grandfather's father had, I can't remember if it was his father or his, oh yeah, my grandfather's father had come home one day and was absolutely, you know, was suffering from depression and stuff like that. And apparently drank rat poison, and then his son found him, and he was panicking because he didn't want to drink the rat, like, he was regretting it instantly, and then ended up dying in the hospital, which is kind of crazy.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, and then that son, years later, you know, successful man, company man, retired, came home, the kids come home, and he was found hanging in the closet.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, and that was my grandfather's brother. So now, I had heard rumblings of this in the family, but it obviously wasn't, like, something you talked about over Thanksgiving meal, you know, like, mm-hmm. So I had heard bits and pieces, but So it's just crazy there. Like, you know, like there's an example of like a regular working guy, and obviously illness has taken over and addictions and drinking problems and who knows what else. But it's, I don't know, it's crazy to think about it, and it's crazy to try to sum up in one conversation too.
Yeah, it's, you're never going to have the right answer. You're never going to be able to figure out the correct combination of stuff. You're never going to figure out if it's more stress, a work thing, a family thing, a you know, missing out on a goal, missing a friend. It's impossible to pinpoint. I mean, the only thing we can do is continue to advance our studies and all with the human mind and,
What are you talking about? Psychology, science, you know? Science never did anything. Never came up with anything. What has science done?
I mean, we got on the moon. Maybe that will cure depression.
Debatable.
Yeah. Well, you're telling me you're going to hang yourself when you're on the moon.
Well, it'd probably be a lot harder.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. You're welcome.
You just float around with this.
You just tie yourself with that American flag and all. It's like, this ain't really doing anything.
But I think the whole thing is to, like, I think conversations are important. Like, conversation. I don't know if we're just seeing it more because, you know, it's in the news and whatnot, and social media is instant. Like, whereas maybe in 1990, you only would have found that. Or Anthony Bourdain dies from the front page of the newspaper, maybe a couple shows, and that was it. Now it's instant. Like, I remember, I mean, I texted you that morning. I was like, whoa, this is pretty crazy. Like, Anthony Bourdain died.
And,
you know, so instantly a bazillion people know in the matter of minutes. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if we're just hearing it more and hearing how horrific suicide is, but there's something there. And I don't know, but I always think conversations are important. Like, I don't have the answer. You don't have the answer. People who even suffer from depression obviously don't have the answer sometimes. So I don't know. But it's Anthony Bourdain was a pretty cool dude, it seemed, anyway. So that's
a shame.
That's that. Yeah. Okay. We lost, and then we lost so many other people from accidental overdoses. Tom Petty this year. Ugh.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. Prince.
Prince, God damn it.
By the way, the name of the show is Verbal Shenanigans, the comedy show that everybody loves.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's it, Berlo. Anything to promote or anything else you got?
I guess we will promote the Swan Dreams Project. As we talked about Aisha Ash before, she was one of our former guests. She's really been working to help getting ballet dancing into the lower income communities and get more kids into dance. If you want to see what kind of stuff she's working on to get more people involved and to help her out, you can go out and Google her her cause. It is the Swan Dreams Project.
All right. Well, I guess sticking with swans and birds and whatnot, I'll promote another former guest.
Are you going to promote bird law?
Yes, I am going to promote bird law. But I am going to promote Sky Falconry. Falconry, well, we had them on. They turned out to be really fun. They're you can learn how to fly a raptor, which, you know, a falcon, and learn how they fly and hunt and have them land on your hand and whatnot. It's pretty crazy. We tried to get them to name a falcon after
Danny Glover.
Yeah, Danny Glover, the Verbal Shenanigans bird. And I had contacted them. They like put up a picture, I think a baby falcon a while ago, and I was like, is that the Verbal Shenanigans bird we talked about? Unfortunately, his name is Alibaba, but in our hearts, he's Danny Glover, the Verbal Shenanigans bird. But they were a lot of fun. So go check out that episode with Sky Falconry out in San Diego, or if you're visiting California, go hunt with the
take some of their tours. Yeah.
So
I guess that's it, man. I guess that. Oh, and let's promote Kirby's video one more time. You guys got to go check this thing out. Go check out Kirby Chambliss with hot air balloons. Just Google that, and it's pretty intense, if you ask me. So it is quite a fun video. But Burloom, I guess until next week. Hopefully, a lot of people don't hunt you down and confirm that you are an actual killer. I will see you next.
That's time. The twist ending.
The twist. We always have a twist. But with that, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Adios, guys.
Later, Scotty.